Support comes from Assistive Technology of Ohio. AT Ohio is a green alternative for used computers. Donating computers not only makes a positive impact on the environment by keeping toxic e-waste out of landfills, they are also refurbished and made available to Ohioans with disabilities. Donation information at atohio.org.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Again and again in the media, we hear coverage about the dangers of violent video games, that they make players more violent or more aggressive. But one recent study shows that participating or playing violent, mature-rated, or shall we say immoral video games actually makes us more moral in our daily lives. Here to discuss his study is Matthew Gizzard, Assistant Professor of Communications at the University of Buffalo. Matthew, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Hi, nice to be here.
How does playing Mortal Kombat, where you're shooting the enemy, or having sex with a prostitute and then killing her in Grand Theft Auto, make us more moral?
Well, we came at this study from a kind of a specific angle, looking at the justification for the actions in video games. When you think about most video games, most of the time the player is given a very just position. He's a hero trying to save the world, et cetera. And so we came at this trying to figure out, well, what happens if you turn that on its head and you ask for players to actually assume a very immoral role in the game? And what we found was that that can actually lead to feelings of guilt, where players actually feel regret for things that they did during the game. And it's that feeling of guilt that actually can motivate increased morality.
Now, that's if you play the game one, two, three times. What if you play the game every day for hours? Does that guilt feeling go away?
So we didn't look at that in this particular study, but we have some research that we've conducted that we're preparing for publication now, where we try to address that very question, what happens with repeated exposure to these types of games. And what we find is that repeated exposure decreases the ability of the game to actually elicit guilt. So if you think of guilt being this kind of motivating mechanism for the increased morality finding that we observed, it kind of shows that, maybe this would happen with the first couple of plays, but over time players would get accustomed to that, and maybe they'd view the game differently after repeated play.
So how did you actually do your study? You had gamers come in and play these games, or did you survey gamers who often play these games?
No, we used experimental methodology to make sure that we could make causal claims here. So what we did was we used a game from a prior study that looked at just the very basic question of, do gamers feel moral emotions for things that they do in a game? So do they feel things like guilt? You often hear different analogies with regard to video gameplay, where some people will claim that video gameplay doesn't affect them at all emotionally in terms of morality, because it's no different than taking chess pieces. The same level of guilt you feel for taking a pawn in chess, you feel for killing a character on the screen. And this research actually showed that, no, there are differences. When you give players just reasons for engaging in violence, they don't feel these heavy emotions. So we used the same game from that study, because it was shown to elicit guilt prior in prior studies, to look and see whether guilt could actually motivate increased moral judgment.
So you used one game in particular?
Yeah, one game in particular. It's a modified game specifically for looking at this type of question. So in the game, players can assume the role of either a UN soldier, which is the justified condition, or they can assume the role of a terrorist soldier. In both of these conditions, players are trying to either liberate a paramilitary torture camp if they're on the side of the UN soldiers, or they're trying to defend that torture camp from of the liberating UN forces.
Can you compare that game to, say, Grand Theft Auto, which is just sort of, I've never played Grand Theft Auto, but from what I hear is just sort of mayhem on city streets involving prostitutes and drug dealers and things like that, where there doesn't seem to be any moral characters in that game. I might be wrong.
Well, yeah, you can. I think you can compare the two. You're right that Grand Theft Auto kind of takes this perspective of, I don't know if it's a straight villain, I would say, but more of an anti-hero type character, characters that you see in movies such as Goodfellas, et cetera, where questionable moral boundaries. But even in games like Grand Theft Auto, there are certain missions that are put in to really kind of push the moral boundaries of the player. For example, in the most recent Grand Theft Auto, GTA 5, There was a mission where you actually torture an individual in a very graphic means to obtain information from them. And the missions like this, and also the infamous No Russian mission from Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, where you're going through an airport as a terrorist and killing innocent civilians, you do see these types of missions in typical gameplay settings where developers are trying to, I think, in a lot of ways, make the player think about their actions in virtual environments and really kind of draw them into those virtual environments.
We're speaking about the effects of violent video games on behavior and on morality with Matthew Grizzard. He's a professor of communications at the University of Buffalo. His surprising study shows that playing these games can actually improve or increase morality in the daily lives of those who play them. Matthew, there have been other studies that show that playing violent video games can lead to violence, and we have anecdotal evidence, I guess you could call it, that, you know, folks involved in mass shootings habitually played violent video games. How do you square your study with those?
Well, so I don't think there's a lot of discrepancy between this study and those. I think a lot of those anecdotal reports obviously have to be taken with the same level of concern that you place on anecdotal reports. But our study doesn't necessarily show that those other studies in terms of increasing aggressive thoughts or increasing aggressive emotions are invalid. And at the same time, I don't think those studies show that our results are invalid. I think what we're doing here is we're trying to look at specific mechanisms in games. So a lot of the earlier game studies that you kind of referenced there in terms of looking at can violent video games increase aggressive thoughts and feelings and even behaviors, they focus on comparing violent games with nonviolent games or with some kind of other control condition. In our study, we're actually looking at two different types of violent games and looking at the justification for the violence in the game and trying to get to some specific mechanisms that we know about from other forms of research, such as guilt being this kind of motivating force for prosocial behavior.
So does your study take an advocacy role for or against certain types of violent video games?
I wouldn't say that it takes an advocacy role for either way. I try to avoid any kind of advocacy in my research because I feel like it can, you know, compromise my objectivity. But one thing that I think we know from previous research is that the forms of violence that we think of as being most harmful, for example, playing this kind of immoral or antisocial character in a video game, I think those can be kind of short-sighted because oftentimes the more damaging roles are those of characters that we see as completely justified. When there is no anti-justification or there is nothing there to make you question the use of violence in a game, it's being conducted for just reasons by a good force, by someone you find attractive or you like, that doesn't give you the opportunity to question whether or not violence is actually harmful or beneficial. So it's only when we're placed in these kind of opposing viewpoints do we start to kind of think about what are the consequences of these actions, and we can view them as being less acceptable. So I think it's kind of counterintuitive in that sense.
So I guess as a parent who has bought video games, you're not saying there's one video game that's one violent game, mature game that's better than another. For instance, you know, a game where you're a good guy shooting zombies versus Grand Theft Auto, where it's just mayhem. I mean, you're not saying one is better than the other.
No, I wouldn't say that one is better than the other. And I think anytime you bring children into the equation, kind of all bets are off in terms of a lot of these assumptions, because children are so capable of being influenced by their environment. I mean, that's the time of our lives when we learn so much.
So your study didn't deal with children. It was pretty much adults who should, like the mature games with 18 plus or whatever should be. You didn't look at how these games affect, you know, preteens and even younger?
No, we did not at all. And in fact, a lot of the assumptions of the study require this kind of established worldview in terms of morality. So we did not look at children at all in this study. This is looking at adult gamers. And the average age of gamers actually right now is around 32. So we do see lots of adults playing games in these kinds of situations.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Matthew Grizzard. He's a assistant professor of communications at the University of Buffalo, and he is out with a study that shows that playing, quote, immoral or violent mature video games can actually increase morality in our daily lives and the daily lives of those who play them. We've heard about this for years, that, you know, playing violent video games makes us desensitizes us towards violence. We've heard the same thing about watching violent movies. Is watching a violent movie going to make us more moral if we relate to the more moral character?
I don't know. It could, I suppose. I think one of the things that's really kind of interesting if you compare things like movies and television versus video games is video games kind of give you an edge on these kinds of moral decisions and moral judgments and thinking about morality because they actually allow you to engage in the immoral or moral acts themselves. With television and film, we're often just viewers judging the appropriateness of the characters we see on screen. We're not actually there engaging in them. So I think video games can be a particularly good area for motivating increased judgments in terms of thinking about moral dilemmas, et cetera. But I think we need to be aware that desensitization can occur. But oftentimes we need to not necessarily just throw desensitization as a negative effect. Desensitization could be positive effects in certain lights.
What about, you know, when you mention a movie, it's completely passive. You're watching all of the action on the screen, whether you're cheering for the bad guy or the good guy. But when you're playing games, sometimes you're actually playing another person, either in the room or, you know, virtually over the internet. Does that change the dynamic when you're the justified person and you're actually, quote, shooting another person who's either sitting next to you or online?
I think it definitely could. It can change the attribution you make. One of the things I kind of want to point out about the study is it's all about the attributions we make for our behavior in the games. So in both of the conditions in our study, the UN peacekeeper and the terrorist condition, both individuals are engaging in the same level of violence. It's not like we had a nonviolent character. And so you can make certain attributions towards whether or not it's a game and you're playing against your friend versus attributing things to the story. So I think that can definitely have a role. How that would play out over time, I think it's too early to kind of tell.
So what's next in your research? What's the next step in your examination of this issue?
So we've got two areas that we're continuing to look at. One is how these effects might unfold over time. And I already talked a little bit about that in terms of looking at whether the ability of games to elicit guilt would decrease with repeated play.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other area that we're kind of interested in looking at is looking at moral pride. So guilt is this emotion that lets us know we've done something wrong. We have moral pride as well, and it lets us know that we've done something right. So, for example, standing up to a bully might make you feel like you've done something right, especially if you're protecting someone else. And so that's another area we want to kind of look at, and I kind of already foreshadowed this earlier as well. Most of the time, we are playing these kinds of moral characters in games. We're not often thrown into the shoes of a completely immoral character who has no redeeming qualities whatsoever. So I think moral pride might actually be kind of a bigger picture question that has a lot more ecological validity when it comes to how players actually play these games.
Okay. Matthew Grizzard, Assistant Professor of Communication at the University of Buffalo. Thanks very much for joining us on Tech Tuesday here on All Sides.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
When we come back, how do we know if what we read on the internet is true? We'll try to figure that out when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Giant camel spiders, lonely girl 15, how to charge an iPod with an onion. All examples of internet hoaxes that many of us fell for, although I never tried to charge my iPod with an onion. Anyway, a new book called Virtual Unreality, Just Because the Internet Told You, How Do You Know It's True? Deals with these hoaxes and how to navigate information in our digital age. And here with us to talk about his book is author Charles Seif. Charles, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Thank you so much for having me.
Charles, misinformation is nothing new. It's ever since there's been information, there's been misinformation. Why is this problem different on the web?
I like to talk about an analogy with epidemiology. What makes a disease turn into an epidemic or a pandemic? It's that the disease spreads very rapidly. It persists outside of its host for a long time. It can transmit across vast distances. And if you think about it, digital information is just like that. It is the most transmissible thing. It goes from the speed of light, from someone's basement in Montana to across the world into Belgium instantly. It persists almost forever. If it's on the web, it's almost impossible to erase. And so in some sense, digital information is a vector for misinformation that is more virulent than anything else we've ever seen.
What's a doozy? When you say a classic example of misinformation that really became true, you know, to users when they never should have. What's your number one example?
Well, I think the most tragic one has to do with HIV denialism. For many years, especially since the beginning of the AIDS crisis, there was a fringe theory that HIV, the virus, was not responsible, that in fact it had to do with drug use and lifestyle choices. And this guy gained a little currency, but the scientific establishment quickly put an end to it, except on the web. And so there were a number of HIV denialist websites out there. And it turns out around 1999-2000, the then president of South Africa, Thabo Mbeki, was doing some internet searches, found these HIV denialist websites, and himself became a great doubter in the HIV causes AIDS theory. So he actually, for many years, blocked the use of anti-HIV drugs in his country. And one estimate in a medical journal puts the consequences as 300,000 people died as a result.
Wow. I mean, that really brings it home that these can have tragic consequences. We joke about the emails we get from, you know, princes and stuff, but that's obviously a tragic consequence of some misinformation.
Yeah, I mean, there's tragedies writ small and writ large. I mean, the Nigerian prince stuff is funny. I mean, you get these terribly written letters promising you hundreds of millions of dollars if you just help someone get money out of the country, but there are certain people who fall for these. If they weren't effective, at least on a small probability, they wouldn't be sending them out. And because digital information is so cheap to produce, the Nigerian scammers can produce millions of these letters, and once in a while they'll hook some sucker. And it causes a little tragedy when they do, because they wind up sending tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars that they can't afford overseas in hopes of getting something that never materializes.
Well, our guest is Charles Seif. He has written a book about how to separate fact from fiction and the history of the misinformation on the web. He's joining us here on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Charles, there's the argument that the web will sort it out, that the community of users will root out the bogus claims, will fact-check folks, and does that work?
Well, one can make that argument, and to some extent it works. Like Wikipedia, which I think is a flawed resource, but it's a very useful resource at the same time, that you have a chaotic group of people that anyone can edit a Wikipedia page. Generally speaking, it's a pretty good resource, so it does work to some extent. But it also fails in important ways, that people who play around with Wikipedia actually create hoaxes can actually alter our perception of reality in subtle ways. One of my favorite examples has to do with a baseball player, Mike Trout, who's an outfielder for the Angels. And someone, making a joke, gave him a nickname called the Millville Meteor because he grew up in Millville, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that the newspaper started citing that item because it was in Wikipedia, and then Wikipedia cited those newspaper articles and encyclopedia articles to prove that, in fact, it was true. And all of a sudden, Mike Trout was surprised to hear people calling him the Millville Meteor, and he started signing baseballs as the Millville Meteor. So in some cases, yes, that there can be a self-correction to the web, but in other cases, an error can propagate to the point where it actually changes reality, that what is true and what is false is actually altered by the falsehood.
Has Wikipedia become more trustworthy since its inception. I know when it first came out, nobody trusted it. But now you see more and more folks trusting it. And there have been studies that show that, you know, it has fewer mistakes than encyclopedias used to have. Has Wikipedia become more trustworthy?
I don't think it's become more trustworthy. I think people are becoming a little bit more sophisticated in how they trust it. That you can't really take anything on Wikipedia for granted, because if it's about a company or it's about a politician or anyone who has an interest in changing it, most likely there is some advertising agency, PR firm, or a politician's aide who has actually altered the webpage. So nothing is truly neutral. Nothing is truly objective. But I think people are becoming a little bit more cynical about Wikipedia. They're no longer quoting things entirely as true as they used to, because the nature of Wikipedia makes it very different than any other reference. And that's one of the key issues here, that digital information isn't an analog of the old versions of information, that in fact there's a different truth value. It is a more manipulable medium than previously we've seen.
We're talking with Charles Seif. He has written the book Virtual Unreality, Just Because the Internet Told You, How Do You Know It's True? If you'd like to join our conversation, 292-8513, what's your favorite internet hoax? Have you been duped by what you have seen on the internet? Give us a call, 292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I tell you, I don't know what we did without the internet, Charles. I mean, I know I have, you know, fixed my car, I've reupholstered a chair, I've, you know, fixed my lawnmower in a matter of minutes by going online and just Googling a question. Does the good that the internet provides as far as information and access to information, doesn't it far outweigh these hoaxes?
Oh, absolutely. I agree. I mean, if you've ever looked up a book with a card catalog, you know that the ability to search every book title instantly has transformed the way we can gather information. The problem is, though, that it's a double-edged sword, that because there's so much information out there, we're increasingly dependent upon digital technologies to help us make sense of it all. And these digital technologies themselves are easily manipulated by outside people, and that becomes a problem.
So what's your best strategy for, you know, separating fact from fiction, to know when you're being manipulated?
Well, I think the key is to take a step back, that we're moving more and more towards a quick reaction, a twitchy society where news is raw and posted immediately. I think the more time we take to sit back, to analyze, to curate, to actually synthesize a real piece of information out of little bits of data, the better off we are. So when you find something on Wikipedia that's interesting, that that is important to you, that should be the beginning of your research, not the end of it. So you go and you try to verify and you dig down to see what the primary sources are and see whether they're trustable. So I think the real answer is to change your relationship to be with information, to be a little bit more of a smart consumer and a skeptical consumer.
That's assuming you want to be a smart consumer. I use the example of politics on the web. Folks on the right and folks on the left tend to just visit sites that back up their point of view. What responsibility do we have as readers of the web, as users of the web, to look for alternative viewpoints and to be skeptical?
I think that's a very good point. It's one of the sad things about the web is that because we're catering, we're having these algorithms cater to our predilections, we are increasingly sheltering ourselves from information that challenges us. And of course, it's the information that challenges us that is really valuable to what makes us grow as people, to what makes us change our opinions. And without that, we are kind of stuck in this endless feedback loop, almost solipsistically wallowing in our own opinions reflected back at us. So I think that one of the things we have to do if we want to avoid getting trapped in our own bubbles is to actively seek out new sources of information, to go to places that make us angry because they're telling us things we don't want to hear.
Is that realistic, though? I mean, it's fun. As a journalist, I love doing that because I just love a debate and I love getting all points of view. So I subscribe to conservative blogs, liberal blogs, mainstream, down the middle blogs. But, you know, that's kind of what I do for a living. So I want to hear all these things. If I'm just, you know, if I don't like the president or I like the president, I want to hear other people who agree with me.
I think it goes against human nature. I mean, you're absolutely right. It's in some ways, it's a lost battle because we don't like getting new information. Changing our opinions is a painful process. Taking down an idea that you had for many years and realizing that you were wrong is not easy. But if we don't challenge ourselves and allow ourselves to do that, then we stultify. So unless we do make that effort, I think there's a great danger that we will all get more extreme and set in our views.
Charles Seif is the author of the book Virtual Unreality, Just Because the Internet Told You, How Do You Know It's True? We're talking about separating fact from fiction and how do we know when we're being hoaxed or being fed a pack of lies on the web. Has the internet made it, has it made it worse? Has it separated society? Because it used to be when you didn't have the web, you had to read the daily newspaper. And yes, the editorial pages on newspapers had biases, and perhaps the reporting was slanted in one way or the other, but it was still pretty much right down the middle. Now, you can ignore the daily newspaper. You can ignore the radio and TV, cable news networks, and mainstream, quote, mainstream news media, and just listen to what you want to read, and that's because of the web.
Yeah, the fragmentation actually happened slightly before the web, mm-hmm. that as the news media proliferated, people stopped trying to broadcast and reach the broadest audience possible, but instead tried to narrowcast and grab a niche more tightly. And this is the great realizations of places like Fox and MSNBC, is that they can piss off 90% of the population out there if they are able to get that 10% loyal, which was never possible when there were only three or four channels out there to broadcast. You really had to try to get your entire audience if you want to make money. So, yeah, I think this is being proliferated from when cable TV struck and then the internet came along, the increasing choice in programming, which is, of course, good in many ways, mm-hmm. allows us to avoid stuff we don't want to hear in a way that we could never do before.
And that fosters fringe ideas and extremism that, you know, really were fringe, and now they're creeping more towards, you know, center-right or center-left, as we like to call it in the news business.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, ideas that were completely out in left field or right field, now, because of the great connectivity of the internet, you can have find fellow travelers who believe the same stuff that you believe, or even be more extreme than you. So ideas which would have died just by lack of oxygen, by lack of people who agree with you, don't die because you have these internet communities building around them. And you've got not just crazy political ideas, but crazy ideas about the way the world works. Things like diseases that really are fictional, delusional. You have people gathering around supporting each other for having these fictional diseases. And we talked about the HIV denialism, but also there's a case called Morgellons disease, which is really just delusional parasitosis. People feel that there's spiders or bugs crawling under their skin. And just by virtue of the fact that these few handfuls of people around the world can connect with one another, they've actually managed to have a fairly sizable lobby looking into the causes of this fictional disease.
Interesting. So what's the solution? We've talked about being more educated readers and educated consumers, but, you know, there are libel laws, there are slander laws. You're not supposed to publish things that aren't true. Is there any way of putting sort of putting it back into the bottle here on the web, or is it just something buyer beware from this day forward?
Well, I'm not sure that there's any easy way to put it back in the bottle. And I think the law is lagging behind technology by a lot. I mean, if you look at what happened very recently with the Facebook experiment, the idea that people who are on Facebook were subject to an experiment where the company altered their moods or attempted to alter their moods shows just how far from what we think of as moral and legal is from what's actually moral and legal. They didn't do anything illegal. In fact, they argue that just by signing up to Facebook, you agree to be part of this experiment. And the outrage that came out shows that what a disconnect there is between what we expect and what is actually happening out there.
So it's a trial and error. Just like you know, trial. You look at a Wikipedia entry, you want to question everything. These companies are using a trial and error business model to see how far they can go and what works and what causes a backlash.
Yeah, and society is following as these places are pushing. So I think the key insight is to be aware that the landscape has changed dramatically in the past 10 years. And everyone's aware that the Internet has changed things, but it's changed our mores and our relationship with information and even our relationships with one another in ways that we don't really understand yet. And it has some great consequences, but it also has some very dangerous consequences as well.
All right. Thank you very much, Charles Seif, author of the book Virtual Unreality. Thanks for joining us here on Tech Tuesday on All Sides.
Thanks so much.
When we come back, Russell Hawley joins us to talk about gadgets, and we'll talk about the biggest technology advance to hit Central Ohio in decades, potato salad, when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. You know, there are lots of tech stories to discuss today, including the new Android Wear smartwatch. It's now for sale around the world. But the big tech story that everyone seems to be talking about today involves potato salad. You may have heard the story by now. Zach Danger Brown, you can't make this stuff up. Zach Danger Brown from Columbus wanted to make potato salad. So we started a Kickstarter campaign. That's the micro donation tool on the web. He wanted to raise about $10, $20, maybe $60 to make potato salad. He's raised tens of thousands of dollars at last count, and he's become a national celebrity and appeared on Good Morning America this morning.
It's unbelievable. I could have never imagined that. I think I thought at day one we had $200, uh-huh. And I thought that was way too much money. I was overwhelmed at the idea of making $200 worth of potato salad.
That is Zach Danger Brown from Columbus. Newfound wealth from Kickstarter to make potato salad. Russell Hawley from Geek.com. What do you make of this?
The first thing I wanted to ask you is potato salad just really popular in Columbus?
It is now.
this is something that happens every once in a while on Kickstarter where it could start out as a joke, and just, you know, the correct number of people see it as a joke and decide that, you know, they can part with $1 or $5 or $10, and it just kind of goes. And we're at an interesting phase of this particular Kickstarter now where, as a joke, we're seeing people, logging on with Kickstarter accounts and pledging extreme amounts of money. And then those pledges disappear after a couple of hours. Within the last 24 hours, we've seen it go from 15,000 up above 40,000 and then back down. It flexes a lot. So it's really hard to tell at this point how much he has actually raised, and unfortunately this is something that Kickstarter isn't going to really be able to help him with, because at the end of the project, which here is August 2nd, then Kickstarter will go through Amazon to try and process all of those transactions.
So, you know,
he should learn something
from public radio. We've call them pledge drives, but we take credit cards now. We don't just rely on pledges. And our fulfillment rate has gone up dramatically since we took the credit card numbers. So these are just pledges, even though it's at $39,000, he may not get all that money.
Right. So this is all done. Kickstarter operates through Amazon's transaction service. So when you agree to a pledge, you make that agreement through an Amazon account. So Kickstarter has a kind of payment information from you already, but the transaction doesn't actually happen until the end of the Kickstarter. And during that time, anyone who has made a pledge to the Kickstarter can either increase or decrease the amount they have agreed to pledge, including removing support entirely. And this is true of every Kickstarter. So it says, you know, $39,087, which is a staggering number for something so silly right now. But it's, you know, by the end of this little adventure, it could either be more or it could be, you know, an order of magnitude less, depending on how the people who have contributed are actually taking it seriously.
I think that some people are taking it very seriously. One first-time donator wrote, quote, "This is important to me on a deep and spiritual level." Another wrote, "For me, potato salad is more than a dish. It's a connection, feelings of love, joy, family, and friends." Just don't leave it out in the sun too long, I guess. People get a reward for donating to Kickstarter, correct?
It varies based on which Kickstarter you participate in, and the rewards are often outlined in detail. So I think that, you know, the people who donated, you know, who agreed to donate $1 or $2, and it went all the way up to $50 eventually. He expanded it after it got so ridiculously popular. But I think that these initial contributors were doing it more as, you know, as kind of a joke to participate. Mm-hmm. But now it's grown to, you know, he's going to release a book of potato salad recipes that goes along with this experience.
Hellman's Mayonnaise is going to donate the mayonnaise.
That's right. It's really funny how this has grown into something that's actually serious now. And that does occasionally happen on Kickstarter. Someone not too long ago made a parody of Google Glass, the $1,500 computer that Google sells, by having a Kickstarter for alcohol tumblers, you know, glass tumblers that had the word Google written across it.
Mm-hmm.
And the Kickstarter, I think, was you know, a couple hundred dollars, and it grew to several thousand dollars for people who thought that the joke was worth contributing money to. So this is something that can occasionally happen on Kickstarter. It just hasn't happened quite to this magnitude before.
The joke ceases to become funny when, you know, this guy now has to make, you know, $39,000 worth of potato salad, no?
Well, no. I mean, the initial agreement that he had was to make potato salad for himself. He was going to make a single potato salad for himself, and then the joke extended to renting out a hall so that he could, you know, live stream making the potato salad and, you know, doing things like that. But he's not actually giving potato salad to much of anyone.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like he's making potato salad and shipping it to people. That would be terrible to begin with. But
he doesn't have any moral responsibility with regards to pay potato salad now that he's raised all this money?
No, I mean, the initial outline for the potato salad was to make it for himself. It was never to make it for other people. So the goal, as far as I can see now, I mean, now he's extended it so that a book is going to come from this, and a T-shirt and a hat and other, you know, kind of swag gifts that come from it. And those are obligations that he will likely uphold. But as far as the actual, you know, potato salad from the, you know, the beginning of this, it was just it was, you know, the original idea was to make it for himself. It was never something he was giving to other people.
I think he might take some grief if he doesn't. Well, he's going to sound like he's
going to. I'm sure that now.
Yeah. Hey, all right, moving on to more serious topics. Less interesting, perhaps, but more serious topics. Android revealed the new Android Wear watches at a conference a few weeks ago. Is that something that folks should buy? Should they hold off? Do we need Android Wear watches? What is an Android Wear watch?
I've spent a little over a week now with LG's version of the Android Wear watch, which is called the LG G Watch, and it is one of two watches that Google announced is actually one of three watches that Google announced, but only two that are available now. One is made by LG and the other made by Samsung, called the Gear Live. And both of them are very, very similar. They're very simple, kind of plain, square-looking watches that you can replace the watch band, with whatever you want and really kind of, you know, make it your own, like you would expect from a normal watch. But it is a touchscreen device that interfaces with your phone. It delivers notifications. It can run fairly basic apps. It is actually a surprisingly capable platform for doing a whole lot more than just telling the time.
Is any one brand of watch better than the other? Samsung, LG, are they all pretty much the same?
Samsung and LG seem to be pretty similar in the watches that they've designed so far. Samsung's screen is a little higher quality, but LG's watch has a little greater battery life. But the watch that a lot of people who have been focused on this project for the last couple months as Google has been working on it is actually the one that Motorola is planning on releasing later this year, called the Moto 360. And the biggest reason for that is that the watch is actually round, like a traditional watch would be. And that raised a couple of pretty interesting questions because, you know, traditionally when you see LCD displays, they're square for a reason. And so having this round display not only looks nice, but it's a technical improvement on that display technology.
Yeah, I can see a round watch being more appealing to wear than those square things that I've seen.
It definitely looks a lot nicer. I spent a little bit of time with it, but haven't been able to take one home and play with myself. But they definitely look much nicer. And if you were interested in smartwatches, I would say that's probably one worth waiting for. But we don't really know, pricing or availability yet.
You need an Android phone to use these watches?
Currently, you need an Android phone to use these watches, and that accounts for a lot of phones that are out there. But much like Google Glass and some of Google's other products, Apple support is something that will likely happen in the not-so-distant future.
Is it similar to Google Glass? Do you think it'll perform about the same as Google Glass? How can you compare the watch to the Glass?
Well, they serve a lot of similar purposes when it comes to displaying notifications so that you can observe them at a glance instead of having to reach down for your phone, like maybe if you're in the car or if you're walking or something like that. But there's a staggering price difference there. The LG G Watch and the Samsung Gear Live are both in the $200 price range, whereas the Explorer edition of Google Glass is upwards of $1,500 for the base model. So there's obviously some pretty significant difference there as far as price and having this computer strapped to your face versus having something, fairly plain looking on your wrist is a pretty big visual difference as well.
We're speaking with Russell Hawley from Geek.com. We're talking about the latest tech gadgets on Tech Tuesday here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann. One more question on the watch. You know, you mentioned that it's on the wrist. That's a great place to monitor your pulse. That's a bit disconcerting. The folks going to want to give their heart rates up to Google and find out when they're sleeping and stuff like that?
Well, this is, sleep tracking and stuff like that. Those are things that, the fitness trackers and smartwatches that have existed before have already done, particularly Samsung's watches. So I don't know that there's so much a privacy concern there as far as having the information available. But Samsung's device has made it so that you can check your pulse. I've gotten mixed reports from, people who have used it as far as how efficient it is, especially after you've been kind of active and maybe you're a little sweaty as to how accurate the pulse measure is. But it's an interesting feature to have, especially if you're interested in that kind of, constant fitness measuring that we're seeing a lot more of right now.
Are we going to see ads pop up on our Google searches for Ambien if we're not sleeping enough, or new exercise equipment if we start to exercise more?
I don't think that we're quite that far, but it wouldn't surprise me to see, directions to your favorite restaurant or something like that show up on your wrist if you were in the area.
I see. The digital tattoo. It's a temporary tattoo developed by Motorola that unlocks your phone. How does that work?
So this is an extension of a piece of technology called near-field communication, which has been around for a little while now. These digital tattoos, these are stickers, basically, that are more, they're thinner and more flexible. It's easy to think of them like the skin sensitive bandages, how you know it feels on your skin when you flex around and move it. You place it somewhere on your body, you know, like your wrist or your forearm or something like that. And if you have Motorola's Moto X phone, then instead of having to unlock a PIN code or trace a pattern or use your picture to unlock the phone, you tap the phone to this sticker, and the secure credentials there unlock the phone.
That seems like a lot of work. You have to remember to put the sticker on and take your phone.
Well, it's not something that, you know, you have alternatives to unlock the phone if you aren't bringing the sticker with you. And the stickers are designed to stay on your body for 5 days, including, you know, showering and running around and doing things. And I've tried two of them now, and they both hold up for just around 5 days before it starts to feel uncomfortable and need to be removed. So it's not so much something that I would think about using every single day. But if I were on a weekend trip to New York City or something like that and didn't want to be in a place where, you know, my password was, you know, visibly seen being entered or something like that, then this would be, you know, an inexpensive way to make myself just a little more secure when I wasn't at home for an extended period of time.
Okay, so it's a convenient security thing. So you still have access to your phone with your password, even if the tattoo falls off or you forget to put it on or whatever. You just see, you know, it's summer vacation time and go to the beach and you get those henna tattoos at all the T-shirt shops. You could, you know, put two for one and you can get your temporary tattoo to unlock your phone. Is it uncomfortable to wear these tattoos?
No. They're sold in packs of 10 for $10, and they're really just very thin and very light. They don't look great because the image over top of the tattoo is this kind of copper design. So depending on your skin tone, it sticks out a little bit. I had my wife actually look at it and thought that I had damage, like a cut or something, and there was a scab forming over my wrist. So they're not this first design isn't the most appealing visually, but they work exactly as advertised. It was really interesting to have that kind of added layer of security and something that someone trying to take my password or something like that by glancing over my shoulder or something like that wouldn't be able to get this password from me.
So they don't say "I love mom" on them or anything like that. The tattoos?
No, it's just these really simple kind of copper-colored shapes and designs.
Interesting. Okay. Video games, Halo 5. It's coming out soon. What are we hearing about what gamers might expect from this game?
So Halo 5 is coming out next year, and in order to prepare Halo owners or Halo fans for this, because it's been a little while since we've had a Halo game, Halo Master Chief Edition is being released. It is all of the previous Halo games that are in kind of the main storyline are being released. And part of that, as we learned recently, is a series of videos that are going to provide a lot of backstory for some of the characters that are going to show up in this new game. So if you are interested in the stuff that's coming up for Halo 5, the Master Chief Edition is what we originally thought was kind of a high-definition remake of these games from the previous Xboxes, but we now know is also going to include a ton of extra information specifically applying to Halo 5. So it's playing through all of the old versions of the game, but then also getting us ready with a lot more backstory for this fifth game that arrives next year.
And that's available now? The Chief game is available now?
The Master Chief Edition of Halo is going to be available in November. They're doing pre-orders now. And it's $60 if you want the digital version or the physical version. They haven't announced any crazy collector's editions like Microsoft has done with Halo games in the past. Some of them have been, you know, upwards of $200 and included, you know, realistic Master Chief helmets and stuff like that. But so far we haven't seen anything like that, which probably means they're saving that craziness for Halo 5. But for now, this is just a cool way to kind of get yourself caught up and get ready for the next game.
So the line between video game and TV series is blurred even further then.
Well, that was a big part of Microsoft's launch of the Xbox One, was the ability to combine kind of digital content and video games in a single platform. That was one of the big messages that they wanted to send everyone away with when the Xbox One was first released, and this is going to be the first real test of that.
Mm-hmm. What are your expectations? Will they meet that test?
I'm definitely a big fan of Halo, so it may, I may be a little, my judgment may be a little clouded here. But everything that we've seen so far, it really looks like it's going to be a big push forward for the Halo franchise.
Russell Hawley is the tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks very much for discussing everything from potato salad to video games. Thanks for joining us here on Tech Tuesday. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher. Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. She hopefully will be back tomorrow here on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.